So in vipassana, this insight practice, this is the looking into the way things are. You use this reflective, this satipanya, satisampajanya, yoniso manasikara, which is another Pali word for getting to the, you know, to the very root. So you see the reality rather than just be carried along on the surface of the five khandhas. So this retreat, exploring this five khandha teaching, five aggregates, in terms of direct experience, not in terms of theory or analysis, but just using that as a way to get perspective on the experience of this present moment. Because all these things are pointing to this awakened reality now, but then the conventional reality is what we usually regard as reality. So when people say they live in the real world and they say, we don't, I'm going, leaving Amravati and going back to the real world, whether there's any kind of irony in that statement or sarcasm or assumption that the humdrum life lay people working and buying things and so forth is reality. And it doesn't mean that it's not, but it's how they perceive it. It doesn't mean that reality is more in Amravati than in London, but it means how we, if we are awake or if we're not. Only you know whether you're awake or not. Like I say, I just say, wake me up, and then, you know, so I shake you, I say, kind of jab you, or I shock you in some way. You go into a momentary kind of state of awakening, but then you just slide back into the old dullness, the old assumptions. So this is where this, even though someone can kind of, a shock might give us a moment of awakened reality, it's so easy to fall back. We can't just live life in the state of, you know, expecting to be shocked or continually stimulated by other beings. So recognize that this is where we take on this, what meditation is about. So it's not being shocked or doing extreme things. I mean, like a shock is usually extreme, or climbing the northern face of the Eiger, or crossing the North Pole, and things like this. Skydiving, bungee jumping, all these kind of life-threatening daredevil things, Evel Knievel, riding a motorcycle across a canyon, you know, leaping across from one cliff to another. Just thinking about it scares me. But I mean, it must be a pretty thrilling thing to be able to do that, have that kind of life-defying or even death-defying ability to do the most kind of difficult daredevil experiences. And yet to have to spend your life doing that, to be awake, is rather pathetic, isn't it? So in the seeking one kind of extreme form of life-threatening experience just to have that sense of being awake. And there's one thing of, like, I find in trekking and things like that, is this kind of, life is simple and you're kind of, it's physically demanding and you have to, you know, have to just exist, really. You don't have time to think all that time about how, you know, yourself or the problems of life. You're just more or less step by step learning to keep going. So in monastic life, you see, trying to bring it down to that more, that sense of simplicity, step by step. And not think of monasticism as something that's supposed to be, you know, something that inspires you all the time, or, you know, gives you highs and making it demands on it that you know, can't be sustained. It's not a sustaining. Those things you can't keep going in anything or anywhere. So it's finding that ability to sustain attention within the daily life, step by step. Breathing, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. Using the most ordinary human movements and experiences. So when I just contemplate, these are my reflections on the five khandhas, take it for what it's worth. But the, you know, like being born, so physically born, one can see that there's a, like a newborn baby, isn't it? A body and consciousness. So rupa and vijnana are the result of birth. While the child is in the womb, then it's still part of the mother, isn't it? It's like it's umbilically connected and so forth. When the birth takes place, then that physical connection, you know, direct physical connection is severed. So there's a sense of seeming sense of a separate entity, physical, conscious entity in the world. So this is why I keep pointing to to rupa and vijnana is they're natural conditions. They're not artifices. We don't create them. You know, I don't create my body or my consciousness. And no matter how, you know, how acculturated I am, you know, how, you know, whatever ethnic background I'm from, or religion, or civilization, education, or race, or class, or anything like that, those are acquired, and those are artifices that come to us through conditioning after birth. So you're not born working class or upper class, or born even with the perception of yourself as a male or female. After a while, in child, you discover the difference, but it's and usually these differences are, you know, very much attitudes about femininity, masculinity, or, you know, a cultural. A lot of them are just, you know, very strong cultural perceptions of what men or female, the female or the male condition is. But that's acquired, isn't it? That's not, that's a, that, so it can be, it can be in a line with the kind of natural observations, or it can be a total kind of delusion. What a male or a female is, it can be sick, it can be totally distorted, and still if we acquire such a perception, we perceive ourselves through the distortion of that perception. So then when you get to Vedana, then that's feeling, pleasure, pain, and neutral. And that's natural too, to this realm. It's a sense realm. So you're born with eyes, you know, and you start learning to see things and hear and smell, taste, touch. And you feel hungry or feel, you know, the babies feel, you know, they're aware of hunger or discomfort, too hot or too cold, and the basic Vedana operates. And so that's natural too. It's a part of the sense experience, the sentience. So there's sentience and consciousness, physical, the body, the senses, sentience and consciousness. So this sentience appears in consciousness, so does the body. As we begin to say use mindfulness, what we're doing then, say how I see this, is this awareness in just pure state of attention. Then you're aware of consciousness, of being conscious, rather than you're not aware of consciousness as an object, something separate, but you can realize consciousness is like this. So that's why I use this sound of silence as a kind of, you know, it helps me to just notice, because that's a natural thing that I can relate to. It's always present. And it's not conditioned by me. It's not a personal feeling or perception or anything. It is what it is. So that's how I reflect on consciousness, is like this. So there's no self yet arisen, see, in the body. So using this awareness just to reflect on the experience of the physical body. So, you know, just with my eyes closed, I'm aware of the posture. As soon as I think sitting posture, I'm aware, awareness. And that awareness brings it into a consciousness, isn't it? So the body arises in consciousness. So you think, right foot, and then right foot, it rises in consciousness. Or left little finger, you know, so you can just, you know, can go from one point on the body to the whole body, the perception of whole body, and the sense of the whole body is conscious. So consciousness is like a screen, isn't it? Like a cinema screen or a television screen. It's blank. It has no quality of, in its own right, of being anything other than conscious. Not red or green or male or female or good or bad, right or wrong, me or you. So you have this awareness as it means consciousness as the reality, and then the four khandhas, the can be reflected in that, in terms of anicca dukkha anatta, in that impermanence, unsatisfactory not self. So then vipassana is the three sinyata, or three characteristics of existence. Now the English word existence means that which arises in consciousness. It doesn't, you know, when we think of these kind of theological arguments about the existence of God, you know, it becomes rather silly, doesn't it? Does God exist or not? And it's up to me to decide, you know, or take a side with one or the other, that God doesn't exist or God does. When we say God exists, then we affirm that with perceptions of God and perceptions of existence. Or we, if God doesn't exist, then it sounds like no God. I don't believe in God. There isn't any God. And it doesn't really exist. Not real. Or, now from the reflective state, isn't it? What exists in terms of this moment? What comes into consciousness then? What pops up? The body? Breath, and you can be aware of the body, the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara. Does God pop up? So maybe the perception of God, you know, you have a perception, or you've created an image of that you regard as God, so that could pop up. But that, then we're looking at what arises and ceases, isn't it? All conditioned phenomena is impermanent, is anicca, dukkha, anatta. So the logic then, if God exists, then he also arises and ceases. So then you can say God doesn't exist. But then this which is aware is, we're taking that which doesn't exist, isn't it? We're not, you know, our refuge isn't in that which exists, but in the pure present. You know, so it, like this awareness allows this recognition, realization of the pure present, the awareness, consciousness, reality. Which is you can't reflect on it, you can't kind of, it doesn't pop up, it doesn't kind of arise and cease. You have to trust in it, you have to relax into it, open to know and to realize this. So then you have this perspective now on, say, vipassana, then is exploring that till you really, you know, the insights come, the jnana dasana comes through this you know, really reflecting and noticing. And it's not believing, having some kind of new theory about the five khandhas, or going along with what I'm saying, some kind of, Ajahn Sumedho says, attachment. It's not vipassana, it's your insight, your exploring, the yoniso manasikara. So in vipassana, see, it is like a vipassana, the word now is kind of fashionable. So they say, you know, in the West, we say, we do vipassana. It's become like Zen almost, where it's even divorced from Buddhism. Like Zen, it used to be, we're Zenists. Are you Buddhists? No, we're Zenists. Remember in California years ago, they didn't want to become Buddhists, but they just took Zen, you know, and said we're Zenists. And so they're doing this with Vipassana. We practice Vipassana. No, we're not Buddhists. We practice Vipassana, that kind of thing. Decide I'm just going to take this bit out. And which is fair enough. But it can get the wrong view of Vipassana, and Zen can be misunderstood from seeing it as some kind of meditation technique alone. You know, some stylistic presentation of sitting posture or doing something in a particular methodic way. And it's much more than that. It's not that's only a little bit of Vipassana. So anicca dukkha anatta. I see so many people think that they're really investigating anicca dukkha anatta when they're kind of projecting these ideas onto experience. So it's, you know, just trying to convince yourself everything's impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. So you get these kind of vipassana types that say, everything is suffering, everything is unsatisfactory. A way of putting down life and kind of dismissing experience by going along with the idea that everything is unsatisfactory. It's all dukkha, and there's no self, and it can. That's not vipassana. That's just grasping those terms, anicca, dukkha, anatta, or grasping somebody's view about vipassana. So the awakening, awareness, consciousness, and then we have, can see the self in perspective. Now, with awareness and consciousness, what exists on the screen right now is a form of Ajahn Sumedho and all the, you know, my memories, my thoughts, my views, my opinions, identifying my body, all this is then seen in terms of they exist, you know? Ajahn Sumedho can exist. But like everything that exists, you can't sustain it. It has no permanence. Ajahn Sumedho has no permanent existence. So if I think I'm Ajahn Sumedho from now until I die, that's another perception. So I examine the Ajahn Sumedho that is present, that exists now, and when it doesn't exist, when there's no Ajahn Sumedho. It's like, you know, I've done this for many years now, just keep exploring that, and knowing that no Ajahn Sumedho is like this. Ajahn Sumedho doesn't exist. And then I can create Ajahn Sumedho as an act of will. I'm just about thinking about myself. I am Ajahn Sumedho, and I'm that American monk that flew helicopters in Vietnam and was a medical doctor in the Navy. All this kind of stuff. I never was any of those things, and yet people, you know, have all kind of, because of the kind of inept way my biographical sketches get produced, get all these funny ideas, get me mixed up with Prabhakaro. So I can create, I'm like God, can't I? I can create Ajahn Sumedho just as an act of will. Or just a heedless moment, you know, just suddenly lose it and suddenly get lost in my own, the sense of I want this and I don't like that and I fed up with this and I'm dissatisfied and... I'm getting old now, and will you need me? Will you feed me when I'm 67? So you can see, like, all the world is a stage, and it is, actually, you know, it's a fairly good metaphor for conventional reality, acting roles, you know, creating ourselves into various personalities or identities that exist. And then we assume that we exist in the same identity all the time. So I can assume that I'm Ajahn Sumedho all the time. You know, when I'm not Ajahn Sumedho, I assume that I'm still Ajahn Sumedho. So when I'm asleep, you know, I'm Ajahn Sumedho asleep. And when I'm, they can call that conventional reality. That's a convention that we use. But in terms of yoniso manasikara, getting to the roots of the reality, which is now, is that Ajahn Sumedho is a perception, it's created. It wasn't even the name given to me when I was born. Given to me when I was 32 years old. The Sumedho part anyway, not the Aja. So. So then, when I was born, my parents gave me Robert. And then they gave me my mother's maiden name, or the middle name, the Kaur, K-A-R-R. Father's surname, Jackman. That's kind of good enough name. But I wasn't satisfied with it. Because my generation, there were so many Roberts, and we never used the word Robert. We called Bob, Bobby. So you go to school, you start going to school, and they say Bobby, and about five, six little boys answer. I thought, I like a really unusual name, you know, that no one else has. So I'm satisfied with Sumedho. But these are just the sense of me being Bobby or Robert or Sumedho. These exist, you know, in terms of memory. They arise in through memory, perception. But then they're not sustainable, are they? They're anicca and they're anatta. They have no, you know, the self of Robert or Sumedho is, there's nothing, when you examine it, there's no kind of soul or essence, kind of permanent essence to it. It's very ephemeral. So, I mean, like people who have amnesia forget who they are, forget their names, because it's a conditioned thing, identity with the race, as being black or white or Asian, or that's a cultural creation. Identity with gender, male or female. Identity as if we were permanently, you know, because of the body is male and I am a man all the time, even when I'm asleep. So then we find, like, cross-dressers really confuse us, don't they? Because then they dress up, they wear like women's clothes, but they've got men's bodies. And, well, it's confusing, isn't it? Because we like to keep things clear, you know, that men are like this, women are like this. Men wear clothes like this, women wear clothes like that. That's right. That's the way it should be. But if a woman starts looking like a man, a man like a woman, that's not the way it should be, isn't it? That's not right. Something wrong. So these are cultural. These are conditions. Perceptions that we can really, you know, get violent about or abusive or nasty over just something like that, because we're so attached to the conventional reality as real. So anyone that challenges conventional reality can be seen as perverted or sick or crazy or heretical, criminal. So this reflecting on the what exists, then we're aware of what with awareness and consciousness going together in this present moment. It's not male or female for me. I'm reflecting on it. That has nothing to do. It's, you know, it reflects that perception only. But it's not, even though the body is masculine, this awareness consciousness is not, the body is something that arises in the consciousness and according to conditions. So even though the body goes on till it dies, we're not conscious of it as an object all the time, isn't it? And the identity with it is even, you know, that's very ephemeral. So this is why the refuge in this awareness, sati panya, sati sampajanya, buddha dhammasangha, so then consciousness arises when we see things, you know, there's chakku vijnana and sota vijnana and so forth, and so as the eye contacts the object, then that perception arises. But the sense consciousnesses are, you know, they're reflected in consciousness when the conditions are there. Sense experience, or just with, even if the senses should all stop functioning, you have the mind itself, memories, emotions. But the awareness then allows us to keep the perspective on all that is subject to arising and subject to ceasing, sape sankara anicca. until so keeping vipassana, sometimes I notice with so many in the vipassana world, they just keep to that reflection on anicca, dukkha, anatta, and they never, they seem to keep doing that for years, and because they get these ideas that is vipassana. But in the terms of the Four Noble Truths, then, the Third Noble Truth is cessation, the reality of cessation. So this is where the first two Noble Truths, using suffering, dukkha, and the causes of dukkha, the arising of dukkha, and the cessation of dukkha, and the path, more and more I find, it's no longer, don't have to contemplate anicca, dukkha, anatta, because, I've had the insight into that is, it's not, you have to keep repeating it. Once you really know that, you don't have to go around thinking anicca, dukkha, anatta all the time, but noticing, using experience of life is cessation. When there's no Ajahn Sumedho ceases. So say I no longer have to go around thinking the perception of Ajahn Sumedho is anicca, dukkha, anatta. I figured that out long ago at the inside. But the knowing, the discerning when there is and there's not is like this. So I can become Ajahn Sumedho when the conditions call for it. It's nothing wrong with being Ajahn Sumedho. That's a convention that can be used skillfully. Being Ajahn Sumedho can be used skillfully. So that's not anything to kind of annihilate. But knowing when being Ajahn Sumedho is appropriate, the time and place, and things like this. That takes satipanya, wisdom, to know when that perception is appropriate or not. As an ongoing assumption, it's not. Me as Ajahn Sumedho, ongoing. No longer, that's not real for me, but this no Ajahn Sumedho, then it's a relief to not be any, not be attached to any perception or being, having to be anybody at all. So the awareness of no Ajahn Sumedho is peaceful. So, like yoniso manasikara, it got to the roots of that Ajahn Sumedho, the presence and the absence, the arising and the cessation. Now, promoting myself as Ajahn Sumedho for the rest of my life is not the path, that's not the Fourth Noble Truth. So if I'm on a kind of Ajahn Sumedho trip, I'm going to, I want to be the most famous Buddhist monk or, build myself up as a kind of great personality or some important being, then that's not the Eightfold Path, that's delusion, that's avicca, bhajya, sankhara. There's no... The reality is no Ajahn Sumedho. So then the path is that, is being able to discern when being Ajahn Sumedho is appropriate or not. Rather than to keep affirming, I am this person, this name. So in terms of, you know, my experience of this, then this sense of just being, this silence, this stillness, this conscious moment, making no claim to it on a personal level. It's just like this. It's not my attainment. You know, the I, Ajahn Sumedho, have attained this in some way. It's not, that doesn't ring true. Natural state. Not a something I've created and that I've attained, because Ajahn Sumedho is no longer there. Ajahn Sumedho can't attain it. So you notice that this no Ajahn Sumedho, and then when that perception, and either through using the perception on a conventional level, or if I get caught up in my own in the old habits of becoming Ajahn Sumedho, then I can get, you know, fall back into being this person. But there's a stronger awareness now not to believe in that. No longer do I believe in the things Ajahn Sumedho thinks and feels as a person. They're not anything that I want to hold to or keep in any way. Conception or karmic formations, emotions, emotional habit. You know, this is the person, the personality, Vedana Sanya Sankara. So when Vedana's pleasant, then I really like that. I want happiness. I want to be happy. I want to be free. I want to be successful. I want people to like me. I don't want to be looked down on. I don't want to be rejected. I want to be appreciated and respected. And I'm, you know, I'm, will you still need me? Will you still feed me? And I, you know, I've devoted my life to Buddhism. Well, that kind of thing, then that kind of, that I can, you know, emotion, somebody insults me or abuse me in some way, emotions say, oh, terrible person, I'm not going to speak to them again. But I know I'll never follow those kind of feelings. I don't believe in that anymore, in the kind of personal emotional reactions I have to experience. Because of yonisomanasika, seeing the emptiness of it and seeing the suffering, the way I suffer when I become this personality again and get lost in me as a person. So then the sanya sankhara is, you know, this recognition for what is memory. I still can remember a very good memory. And emotional habits still, I still feel, you know, again, I have really kind of, you know, strong feelings and emotional reactions to things. But now there's a recognition of it in terms of it's a mental object. I'm not that emotion. The emotion is what it is, you know. So it's not trying to say I don't feel anything, or I no longer have any emotions. I'm completely liberated from emotions now, and I don't have any. And so I just kind of, you know, whatever happens, I just completely indifferent. Nothing affects me because I'm liberated and freed from those kind of conditions. Is another, you know, that's another personality arising, isn't it? Kind of assuming I am an attained person in some way. But in terms of the reality, the emotion still have emotional life. But I no longer believe in it. You know, it doesn't hold me, it doesn't convince me anymore. In terms of emotional habits, you know, like this sanya sankhara, karmic formation. So I notice I can cry much more easily than I ever have through all these years. When I was younger, I didn't cry. I trained myself. Boys don't cry. It was absolutely humiliating, you know, when I was a child. The way to be really abused and made fun of is to be caught crying. So, you develop these messages. Boys don't cry. And then you develop ways of inhibiting that tendency. Now I find I know the identity is gone, so crying is kind of natural to a situation. It's a natural response where that isn't through controlling anything. So I'm just like sadness, or I hear sad news, or read in the newspaper some sad news about, you know, innocent people being murdered or whatever, and I can feel the sadness of that. Even if it wasn't true, it's still sad in itself, isn't it? The words in the news, even if it's all made up, it's sad in itself. So then the sadness, that kind of sadness, especially things like innocent people being abused, I find really sad, bringing tears to our eyes. Or, you know, that's a very sad perception. Goodness being despised and like I find all these things about, you know, children being abused and beaten and sexually abused. I find this really sad, you know, because to me, innocence, the thing that I find inspiring is protect the innocent. You know, the noble male side of me is the protector of the innocent, not the exploiter. So I find that inspiring, you know, where somebody stood up and helped the innocent, you know, and protected them. And I thought, oh, that's inspiring. That uplifts and makes me feel inspired. And those who kind of people that take advantage of the innocent and abuse them, really sad. So I can read this in a novel, where it's, you know, made up by the author, still, or see it on a movie or whatever. Because this is just the way it is. There's certain, you know, the things that are just naturally that way. It's not like a loss of control, but just recognizing the sensitivity of this realm is like this. with awareness, you're allowing sensitivity to operate. Where, say, in the conditioning process of my background, I was trying to stop the sensitivity. Like the male, the macho kind of perception was, if you're a real man, you're not sensitive. If you're a man that's sensitive, you're kind of a sissy, you're weak. You can be taken advantage of. And, you know, to be tough and insensitive is where you're safe. Those were the cultural conditioning of my American background. 60 years ago, it was like that. That's how we, that's what everybody subscribed to. It's not that, that's the way you're supposed to be. Nobody questioned it in those days. The general population agreed to those perceptions. Remember this, when Ajahn Amar went to these conferences with the Dalai Lama and Dharamsala, and the nun Tenzin Palmo Junito telling the Dalai Lama about the horrible conditions of bhikkhunis and nuns in the Tibetan tradition, and the Dalai Lama started crying. Just hearing the news, you know, that surprised everyone, isn't it? You think Dalai Lama, you know, the perception of the Dalai Lama crying was such a strange one. To me too. Because, you know, you're creating this perception. Dalai Lama is beyond all that. And yet, from my own experience, I could understand it. When you hear sadness and unhappiness and that. Crying is a natural response. Tears come. So that's why it's not a matter of getting rid of emotions or being frightened of your emotions. You know, to know the emotions from this awareness, consciousness, sati, sampachanya, they're like this. So in the five khandhas then, to see how, you know, that's how I've explored them in the four noble truths. Those are the main conventional teachings I've used all these years. It's just, you know, realizing that, really working with it as experience, not as, I mean, you could read, you know, I could read it and memorize Four Noble Truths, you know, first 10 minutes. It's simple enough. Four Noble, four is an easy number to remember. One, two, three, four. And then you could say, in Thai, the Lungpa Chinese say, Tuk Samudhaya Nirodha Magga, like that. And then they say, Tukha Samudhaya Nirodha Magga. But in Thai, they kind of shorten the term. So, and you hear Lungpa Cha speaking, they say, Tuk Samudhaya Nirodha Magga, and kind of rattle it off like that. So, That's referring to that. But then the meditation is this, it's called vipassana, insight, direct looking, observing, realizing. So then, how does samatha relate to that? Because we say samatha vipassana, we use the words together. And it's easy to explain, you know, samatha is like this and vipassana is like that. But But tamata also is, you know, it's like recharging your battery, concentrating the mind. It's really, you know, it's a skillful means to focus attention on something and just to sustain and to develop and to exercise your mental faculties, increasing levels of refined consciousness. And so it's like doing exercises and, you know, keeping your body fit to so that it doesn't kind of, you know, if you don't exercise your body, it's going to get very sick and weak. And then with all the vipassana, you know, you know, be a lump of misery, of physical misery. Yeah, if you can, you can. If that can't do any better than that, then that's not an obstruction. But why, you know, when you don't have to have such a miserable physical condition, why? You might as well not, you know. So then the exercises, or practicing the samatha meditation, developing the jhanas. And so these are all, you know, skillful means that are recommended and appreciated. So Lungpo Cha used to compare like the samatha is like making a candle and vipassana is like lighting the candle. You know, so if you just spend your time making a candle without lighting it, you might get, you know, pretty huge, fantastic kind of candle. But never be liberated through it until you light it. And the light the candle in the candle that holds the flame for a long time, isn't it? You know, like a good candle will burn a long time to be able to see the things to observe. But some of these really big candles are useless, aren't they? You know, they give you these huge candles sometimes, and then they smoke the ceiling, blacken the ceiling, and you've got to keep trimming them down, and wax keeps spilling all over the place. So you don't even have to have, you know, all that much of a candle, actually. The thing is to light it, you know. These are just metaphors, but they help to put in perspective the, you know, the actually the body itself is like a canvas. We awaken to it, isn't it? We light it. We put it in the light rather than just, you know, dully sit in a dull state just thinking of ourselves in the most conditioned way. So then discerning the Ajahn Sumedho is like this, no Ajahn Sumedho is like this. Or dukkha and no dukkha, suffering and non-suffering. As you really explore that, and you, like suffering to me is when I become Ajahn Sumedho and I want this, I don't want that, and I'm afraid of this, and I feel threatened by that, and I worry and and become self-conscious and on like that, and then suffering. When I really look at that, I'm suffering. Being Ajahn Sumedho and being the deluded that I am this, and I'm caught up in this personality of mine, and then it always takes me to, you know, some kind of miserable angst or despair or worry, feeling of, you know, anxiety or feeling dissatisfied with everything. Where when I let go of that, then no dukkha is like this. So consciousness, awareness, the body's still here. It is what it is. I'm not following any thoughts or emotions, but if they do arise, I'm aware. I know them. There's a knowing. And a realization that I'm not those thoughts or those memories or those conditions. That's jnana dasana. It's a profound knowing. It's not just a theoretical, abstract kind of knowledge. It's gut knowledge through insight. Or attachment and non-attachment. I'm aware when I'm become Ajahn Sumedho and I forget that, you know, I get lost in my sense of myself, then I attach, you know, and I get really carried away. So I know attachments like this and non-attachment is like this. So this, like, discerning the difference where the condition arises and ceases, and the unconditioned, that paradigm comes in, is a good one, I found. The relationship of the conditioned to the unconditioned. So this unconditioned is this consciousness, this awareness consciousness that's present now. And then the conditions through identity, through memory, through emotional habits, through karmic formations, through perceptions, force of habit that comes out of avijja, then all that is, when I grasp all those conditions, then I feel that I'm somebody who suffers a lot. That's the way it seems. When I stop doing that, when I let go, then that fades out. It loses its power to delude, and it starts fading away. So this is just to encourage this investigation. And we have only a few days left of this formal retreat. But it doesn't mean that the end of the Vipassana, does it?